Good evening. It's Sunday, August 29th, 2021. Coming up, 2 weeks into the U.S. withdrawal and evacuation process from Afghanistan, mayhem continues, and many are circling back to the question, what was the U.S. doing there to begin with?
All along, the United States was not interested in Afghanistan in itself, but rather on its surrounding, meaning Afghanistan is a territory to be controlled and fought over, not for itself, but for its geostrategic positioning.
Voting for the recall election to determine whether or not California's Governor Gavin Newsom remains in office is already underway, and people on both sides of the issue are passionate about their positions.
I work at Hurricane Harbor, what used to be Waterworld, and Gavin Newsom shut it down. He shut down my job.
He's not the only governor who had to close things up, so he's being blamed for something that's happening all over the country.
Teachers are gathering in more than 100 cities this weekend to teach truth in protest of the anti-critical race theory legislation being proposed across the country.
We can make our institutions more inclusive and make our policies better as we grow into, as was named in our Constitution, into a more perfect union all the time. That's a process.
I'm Sharon Sabota, and this is the KPFA Weekend Evening News. The August 31st deadline to withdraw all American troops from Afghanistan is quickly approaching amongst fear and mayhem as efforts to evacuate Americans and eligible Afghani people continue. Thursday's suicide bombing outside of the Kabul airport reportedly took the lives of some 170 people and wounded some 200 more, some of whom were reportedly Afghan Americans and U.S. citizens. The White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki called the threat of more violence ongoing and active. This is the backdrop as we approach the 20-year anniversary of the events of 9/11, or September 11, 2001. I spoke with Dr. Hatin Bazian, a professor of Islamic law and theology at UC Berkeley, about how Afghanistan got to this place, what to make of some of the rhetoric we are hearing, and what the future holds for the country and its people. I began by asking Bazian about the U.S.'s seemingly abrupt departure from Afghanistan.
If we think about it, abrupt, I think it's about 20 years too late. The United States should not have been in Afghanistan to begin with. What we need to realize is the United States used the war on terror framing, I put it between two quotation marks, to increase its footprint globally, that the United States have carried out offensive or deployment operation in almost 44 different countries since the events of September 11th, and we're going into the 20th anniversary. After September 11th, the United States immediately said that they will be launching offensive operations. And I said what we needed is to send food and support to the Afghan rather than sending them bombs. And it's been four presidents that have continued to use Afghanistan for a broader strategy of U.S. global hegemonic footprint. The Trump administration, and then followed with Biden, they were trying to get out of a war that had no end or no objectives specifically internal to Afghanistan. And some would have said that the United States and the Afghan army and government might control the cities in the morning or during the day, but Taliban really ran the country at night, which means that the strategy that the United States wanted to fulfill in Afghanistan was actually collapsing on a daily basis.
I would like to just break down some of the things that we're hearing from Biden right now. For example, he said, we can't stay behind and fight in a war that the Afghan army is not willing to fight. How would you respond to that?
Again, this is the army that they trained. So the big question becomes, what was this army set up in the first place to do? In terms of it is not ready to fight, the question is why? I think the United States' first mistake is to actually go into Afghanistan, setting that aside as the first mistake. The second question is what type of training they have actually put in place for the Afghan army. Was it being trained to fail or either trained to continue to funnel massive amount of resources to our military industrial complex? The third, in terms of saying that the United States is not going to fight in there, I think the United States have thrown everything in its arsenal on Afghanistan, from Chaak and Awe, from the mother of all bombs, bunker busters during the Obama administration, using every drone capability that basically we were instrumentalizing drone warfare and killing from a distance. All this, in essence, to blame the Afghan is basically to absolve the United States Army and military of its own failure. And in essence, they don't want to admit that we have failed.
Professor Bazian and I also discussed the emphasis that is being put on Afghani women as the Taliban takes over. Bazian says that while patriarchy and sexism should be addressed around the world, the Western world has often used Muslim women as a trope for their cause, without addressing the domestic struggles of women in their own countries.
If we read Fanon and the Wretched of the Earth, which spoke about the French colonial campaign in Algeria and North Africa, the instrumentalization and the utilization of women and the Muslim women as the site of intervention, that we're intervening to liberate Muslim women from the oppression of Muslim men and the oppression of the brown men. So again, liberating brown women from brown men by bringing in the white man as the savior. And this puts, again, the tension in here, because on the one hand, how do you oppose colonial imperial intervention of Western power while simultaneously addressing the issues that are universal in relations to patriarchy and the oppression that exists? Whether it's Afghanistan or the world, the reason that you have oppression against women is because it's men, not because it's brown men. But in here, the United States immediately shifted to pull out one of the most permanent tools, which is the oppression of women. So we're, in essence, the horrible Taliban or the horrible Afghan, the horrible Iraqi, the horrible Syrians and so on, that is immediately utilized in order to actually absolve us that we're there for good reasons. In general, colonial discourse always uses these tropes as a way to justify its own intervention and also to wash away its own responsibility for what have transpired. I remind people that when Bush and Cheney began to launch the invasion of Afghanistan, it was framed in the way of liberating Afghan women while simultaneously pushing the war on terror. And nobody would, in their right mind, would accuse, even as a comedy piece, both Cheney and Bush of being feminists par excellence, while they were domestically curtailing all aspects of women's rights, opposing maternal leave, still opposing equal pay for women. Yet they were projected to be in Afghanistan to liberate Afghan women. But simultaneously, I remind people that also Democrats at the time, and remember Senator Boxer from California, that she actually called Muslim organizations to see if she could borrow a burqa, which is the Afghan dress, for a press conference about the horrible conditions of women in Afghanistan. So again, the framing of Bush and Cheney at the time that we're there to liberate Afghan women, considering that the framing of only invading Afghanistan for one reason was not sufficient. And also, if you remember, during the Iraq, as Iraq began to be a very difficult terrain for the United States post-2005, rather than saying we're looking for weapons of mass destruction, now we are there to promote freedom, democracy, and freedom of women, even though that in Iraq, the women were far more educated, far more in the workforce, far more having their rights during the period than when the United States. So this is a very, very slick move.
Bazian says that going forward, the best thing that Americans can do to support the people and the women of Afghanistan is to step back and avoid any further military intervention.
We are in a period where every problem is immediately shifted into securitization, into intervention, into military power. And I think what we need is to insist that this should not be the scope or the approach to engage with Afghanistan again, that we have dropped enough bombs, we have killed enough people, we have wasted massive resources, and the Afghans are not better off as a result of this. And therefore, we should insist on not going down that path again.
Bazian says that while women and other marginalized groups will undoubtedly face challenges under the new Taliban government, it will be important to allow the people of Afghanistan to collectively have a say in their future. In terms of being allies to our Afghan and Muslim neighbors and community members who may be the subject of Islamophobic rhetoric and Islamophobia, Bazian says it may be important to cut back on our consumption of mainstream news and to be critical of the narratives we're hearing. Mail-in voting is already underway for California's September 14th gubernatorial recall election. The election is costing Californians some $276 million. Critics say that's an extraordinary amount of money for taxpayers to spend with just over a year until the next election is slated to take place. People on all sides of the issue are passionate about their perspectives. I spoke with both proponents and opponents of the recall election at Todos Santos Park in Concord. Marilyn Kay carried a large sign that said, "Vote yes on the recall." I asked her why.
We have the highest income taxes. We have the highest homeless rate. Governor Newsom has declined to build additional water facilities so that we will have less of a problem with water during our drought seasons. And I've lived here my entire life. I'm 59, so this is not my first drought. And it probably won't be my last.
Some people, particularly around COVID restrictions like masks and the shutdown, seem to get especially interested in the recall. Where do you stand on that issue?
I feel that he did not have the right to be in a recall, to be in a lockdown situation so long that he deprived people of their ability to earn a living and support their families. He put a lot of people out of business.
Aram Saja says he joined the recall effort because he temporarily lost his job that he loved at a water park.
2020 was a huge eye-opener for me. You know, I haven't really been into politics all my life until now. And Gavin is a good place to start because I really want to recall him. I work at Hurricane Harbor, which is the water park, used to be Water World. And Gavin Newsom shut it down. He shut down my job. So
how are you impacted?
No money, man. I can't make any money, obviously, for a whole year. We were able to open this year, which is really nice. But the fact that he has this power, that he's able to shut down my, you know, a business like that and make it so I can't make any money is, I think, unacceptable.
Were you able to get unemployment?
I didn't file for unemployment. I actually found another job at the time. So I was able to work a little bit, but I did still want to work at the water park. You know, I really like working there and stuff and making money there.
Paulina Watts is with the Democratic Party of Contra Costa County. Watts says Governor Newsom is doing a good job in the face of a global crisis.
For me personally, supporting no on the recall, I think the governor's done a fairly good job of trying to protect us under extraordinary circumstances throughout a health crisis, and we're not through it yet, and I think we need to continue to have his leadership through the next year and hopefully thereafter so that we get out of this with the most people successfully and more people who are healthy on the other side of it. I think that this recall is costing us as a state an extraordinary amount of money, and it's such a waste, and that money could be going back into our schools, back into new services, back into healthcare, back into so many other things than an election, when we're going to have an election next year anyway. For me personally, supporting no on the recall, I think the governor's done a fairly good job of trying to protect us under extraordinary circumstances throughout a health crisis, and we're not through it yet, and I think we need to continue to have his leadership through the next year and hopefully thereafter so that we get out of this with the most people successfully and more people who are healthy on the other side of it. I think that this recall is costing us as a state an extraordinary amount of money, and it's such a waste, and that money could be going back into our schools, back into new services, back into healthcare, back into so many other things than an election when we're going to have an election next year anyway.
So I noticed from talking to some of the folks who are here promoting the recall that there might be some misinformation, and then there's people who feel that it was personal or an overreach to shut down in the face of a pandemic. What do you say to those people?
I mean, I understand the personal cost, but I think it was a time when we had this virus that's still circulating in the community and was very contagious and was killing people, and we didn't know how it was going to react. And I think it was the right call to shut down things to try to get a handle on it, because otherwise I think we would have lost hundreds of thousands of more Californians.
And how do you feel about the way he's handling it now? It seems like he's trying to appease everybody a little bit, but how do you feel he's doing now?
I think it's a hard line to walk, and I think he's trying to balance vaccines and mental health and trying to get some sense of normalcy back, but the virus is still here and trying to keep people safe. So I think it's a hard balance, and I think it's going to just take more time.
Kathy McRoberts called the recall efforts a waste of time and money.
I see no need to recall a governor who's doing a good job. I see no need to spend $276 million. We have a surplus. We're taking care of schools. We're taking care of health. We're taking care of our kids. Our COVID numbers are not as bad as some other places. We'd all like them to be better, but it's useless to go through all of that. We're going to have an election.
How you doing, Concord?
Sooner. I think it's a waste of time. I think he's doing a good job.
Some people are saying, well, he took my job away.
He singly took jobs away? I don't think so. We're not the only state in the union where people got laid off. My son is self-employed. A year's worth of salary went down the tubes. But he's not the only governor who had to close things up. I have family in New Mexico, and they had to shut down. They couldn't work. So he's being blamed for something that's happening all over the country.
California's gubernatorial election to determine the fate of Governor Gavin Newsom is set for September 14th, with mail-in voting already underway. As lawmakers in 27 states have introduced or passed legislation that would require teachers to remove or water down discussions of critical race theory or the roles in which racism, sexism, and systemic oppression have in the United States history, teachers in some 115 cities across the country are taking action this weekend with a Teach the Truth campaign. This weekend's action is part of a pledge that 6,600 educators have signed, saying in part, "We, the undersigned educators, refuse to lie to young people about the U.S. history and current events." This action comes on the heels of North Carolina's passage of the Ensuring Dignity and Non-Discrimination in Schools Act, which prohibits schools from promoting the idea that the United States was created for the purpose of oppressing members of another race or sex. The act passed on Thursday in a 25-17 vote, with members of the GOP unanimously supporting and Democrats unanimously opposing it. Cynthia Ganote is a gender and race sociologist at the University of Louisville. I spoke with her about the source of the controversy related to critical race theory and what this means for the future of education.
It's a really specific theory that explains systemic racism. Now, most people had never heard of that until a guy named Christopher Rufo. So Christopher Rufo is a right-wing activist who appeared on Tucker Carlson's show last September, and he began talking about critical race theory. And he said that it posed an existential threat to the United States. This particular act of just naming it in the media meant that the next morning, reportedly, then President Trump called Rufo and said, tell me about this, and let's draft an executive order and cancel government contracts that are either about critical race theory or about white privilege, those kinds of things. So they have made an attempt to put this term out, critical race theory, not define it, obviously. I mean, not tell people what it really is, what are its tenets. You may be for it, you may be against it, but you have to know what it is first. He's taken it and thrown it out into the public dialogue in really manipulated ways. So, for example, Christopher Rufo and others have said critical race theory causes white people to be bullied and shamed. It doesn't. That it is something that is being used to bash our American history, on and on and on, while not presenting what critical race theory really is.
As a longtime educator and scholar, Ganot says it's not possible to do justice to education without also teaching critical race theory.
One of the things that I know as a sociologist is telling people that it isn't a one bad apple approach that will help us understand these things. So what I mean by that is this. If a lot of people are a lot more comfortable believing that there's like one racist guy in an organization and there's that one bad apple, but if you remove that guy, there's no racism in the org or the people or anything else, then we can all move on with our lives. And so as a sociologist, looking at institutions like our schools, like churches, like communities, you have to start looking at where has racism been built in at a systemic level. This is not talking about individuals. It's not saying, and you're racist, and you're racist, and you're racist, and you're racist. It's saying, let's look at these systems. And absolutely, you and you and you and I will all have work to do. We will. This is about naming that racism exists in our institutions. I wish it were as easy as the one bad apple theory. You'd then just pluck that one guy, fire him, everyone else is great. It's not how it works. So really what this represents for me is the ability to get people beyond individualistic thinking, blaming, or shaming, and getting them into understanding systemic racism and saying, we collectively can change these things. We can make our institutions more inclusive. We can make them more fair for everyone, more equitable for everyone. How do we do that? We have to be able to use these analytical lenses and see where racism exists, where sexism exists, where heterosexism exists, where classism exists, and make our policies better as we grow into, as was named in our Constitution, into a more perfect union all the time.
That's Professor Cynthia Ganot, a gender and race sociologist from the University of Louisville. For more information about the teacher's pledge to preserve critical race theory, you can visit www.zinedproject.org. The United Nations Security Council met yesterday to review developments in the war between the Ethiopian government and the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front. KPFA's Ann Garrison reports.
UN Special Envoy to the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman, returned from a trip to Ethiopia, Djibouti, and the United Arab Emirates last week. Then, the State Department announced sanctions on the top general of Ethiopia's neighbor and ally, Eritrea. The UN Security Council met 4 days later about Ethiopia. I spoke to Eritrean-American Elias Amare, a longtime peace and justice activist for Eritrea and the Horn of Africa, about these developments.
Elias, what was your takeaway from the UN Security Council meeting? Did you hear anything we haven't heard there since the TPLF launched the war last November?
Well, there's nothing new. It was a continuation of what they've been trying to do at the UN Security Council. I mean, by they, I mean the United States and its Western European allies, to bring some kind of resolution against Ethiopia that would lead towards intervention. But so far, they have not succeeded. Why? Because China and Russia have been blocking it. This is internal affairs of Ethiopia, and we shouldn't do any undue interferences, how they have been saying so far. The only new thing I heard is that they are going to try now to come through the African solutions for African problems angle, and the African Union is going to appoint the former president of Nigeria, Olusegun Obasanjo, as the high representative for the Horn of Africa to try some kind of mediation. But again, that is not new, because when the conflict started 9 months ago, for example, the South African president had tried some kind of mediation, but Ethiopia was strong and adamant on that. It said, this is an internal matter, we will settle it on our own. So I don't see much new, except Obasanjo is now being appointed as high representative. What he will accomplish, we will see.
I heard some members of the council, as usual, call on Eritrean troops to withdraw from Tigray. these were Westerners, but I didn't hear anyone say that they have withdrawn. Are they still there, or do you know?
I don't think Eritrean troops are there. I mean, I'm not on the ground, but from all information we have, Eritrea had withdrawn back in June to its territory and is monitoring the border with Ethiopia along the Tigray border in case they, meaning the TPLF, take another reckless action. You remember at the beginning of this conflict back in November of last year, in order to widen the conflict, the TPLF, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, which is the culprit, we must say, which started this war in the first place, ignited it by attacking Ethiopian troops in the dead of the night on November 3. Well, in order to widen the war, it also launched rocket missile attacks against Eritrea. Not once, not twice, not three times, no, no, 15 times, bombarding civilian targets in Asmara, near the capital of Eritrea. Thank God it didn't land on any civilian population and no harm was done, but it tried. So it was this that pushed Eritrea to take measures to protect itself and to neutralize those heavy weaponry in the hands of TPLF. So once that mission was accomplished, Eritrea had withdrawn in June. In fact, that's what the latest statement from the United States says. Eritrea had withdrawn in June, but now again they have re-entered. So we are obliged to ask, if Eritrea had withdrawn in June, all along June, July, August, the past 3 months, look at the statements of Samantha Power, the chief of USAID. She has been saying persistently, Eritrea must withdraw, Eritrea must withdraw. So how is it that they acknowledge now that Eritrea had withdrawn in June, and yet the past 3 months they have been harping on this withdrawal issue? I don't think they are serious. They are just creating pretext to punish Eritrea.
So they say Eritrea must withdraw, but now they're saying Eritrea withdrew in June, and now it's re-entering.
Yes.
Yeah.
The tune has changed.
Okay.
That, yeah.
Last week, the U.S. Special Envoy to the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman, returned from a visit to Ethiopia, Djibouti, and the United Arab Emirates. Then on Monday this week, the State Department announced that it was sanctioning the Chief of Staff of Eritrea's Army, General Philippos Wode Yohannes. What do you make of this?
Well, it is the usual tactic of bluster. The target is ultimately the Ethiopian government. So in order to frighten the Ethiopian government into submission, into accepting the TPLF as an equal and sit down and negotiate with them, they are trying the Eritrea route. And there's basically the language is, if you don't oblige, the same thing will come to you. As far as its consequences, the sanction based on the Magnitsky Act is targeted at this time at the Chief of Staff, General Philippos Wode Yohannes. This general, he doesn't have any assets in foreign banks. He's a poor man, like all Eritrean leadership who live a very modest life on their salaries and a clean, corruption-free life. So it's meaningless and symbolic.
Do you expect any kind of U.S. or proxy intervention beyond what's already happened?
All the signs are there. I cannot ignore the warning signs. The rhetoric and the statements that are coming are leading towards that. But population determined of Ethiopia and Eritrea is determined and they have stood united. The media is hopeless. The disinformation that we know lead to war, we have seen this before in Iraq, in Libya, in Syria, in Yemen, what have you. The pattern is there. An intense propaganda of lies and disinformation from the mainstream corporate media. But those in the anti-war peace movement have to continue to expose these lies because their lies lead to war. So we have to bring the truth in order to make peace possible, I think.
In Berkeley, for Pacifica, KPFA Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
And the weather. In the San Francisco Bay Area, clear tonight with a low of 56, partly sunny tomorrow with highs around 70. In the central San Joaquin Valley, clear tonight with lows around 70, hot and sunny tomorrow with highs expected to top 100. Thanks to Ann Garrison for helping to prepare tonight's news, and to you, our listeners, for tuning in. I'm Sharon Sabota. Good evening.